Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
I was calling out Russia's efforts to undermine democracy and the international system before it was cool to do so, I think.
Welcome to It's All Political, the San Francisco Chronicle's political podcast. I'm Joe Garofoli, the Chronicle's senior political writer. And today in the podcast, we're talking to Ambassador Dan Baer. Now, he's running for the Senate, the U.S. Senate in Colorado. And if he's elected, he will become the first openly gay man to be elected to the Senate in the history of the United States. So we talked to him about his time growing up in Colorado, and we talked to him about being an openly gay ambassador, which was, there are not too many of those. The Russians were deeply suspicious of him. He has a lot of good stories for that. Stay tuned to listen to Dan Baer on It's All Political next. Ambassador Dan Baer, welcome to It's All Political. Welcome to the city of St. Francis, San Francisco.
Thanks very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So you are running for the U.S. Senate in Colorado. That's a seat currently held by Senator Cory Gardner. He's a Republican guy. And you're running about, what, how many other Democrats are in there? Like 10?
At last count, I think that might be right, okay. Yeah.
10 other Democrats in the primary. But if you were elected, you would be the first openly gay man to be elected to the U.S. Senate. And now we know Colorado now is a purple state, for LGBT folks of a certain vintage, and you're 42, it was known as the hate state back in the day. A lot of anti-gay legislation back there. I found that there's a poll done in 1992 where two-thirds of the people in Colorado didn't even know a gay person. Did you ever hear that?
They obviously thought they didn't know a gay person,
yes,
you know.
Yes, key to that one.
Most people who say they don't know a gay person just don't know that they know a gay person.
yes. And you said you grew up in a place, Littleton, Colorado. It was a suburb, well-to-do suburb of Denver, that, quote, wasn't yet hospitable to LGBT people. And that was a good high school. What was it like for you 25 years ago going to high school there? Why wasn't it, how wasn't it hospitable to gay folks?
Well, I mean, I wasn't out at the time, but I certainly had a sense that it wasn't possible for me to be out, and that has changed. I know that the school now has a gay straight alliance or an ally group. Mm-hmm. You know, I remember very well when Amendment 2 passed. I was 15 years old, sophomore in high school, and while I wasn't yet sure what was going on inside me, I had a sense of being different, and I had a sense that this was a public condemnation of who I thought I might be. I think one of the things you learn about laws, especially as a diplomat, one of the things I saw around the world is that laws have a pedagogical effect. They have a teaching effect. And when I would travel the world for Secretary Clinton or Secretary Kerry, and I'd meet with the justice minister or the foreign minister in some country in Africa or Asia, and they would say, yes, we have this law in the books that bans homosexuality, but we never enforce it anymore. You know, obviously it's good that they don't enforce it, but it still teaches people that is something that they ought to be ashamed of, that they can't be welcome, that they can't live a public life. And, you know, as a 15-year-old in Colorado, the idea that I would, frankly, you know, just 16, 17 years later, join the State Department as a senior official and 20 years later, 21 years later, be the fourth openly gay U.S. ambassador was completely unthinkable to me. And I think one of the things that inspires me today is just the idea that the life that I've led has been one that has only been made possible by others who have invested their efforts as activists, as political leaders, as lawyers in driving political change that made it possible for a young queer kid somewhere in America today to see a much different future than the one that I could see from the vantage point of 1992. And somebody who's lived the life that I've led can't afford to be cynical about the possibility for progress.
What kept you going in those days? What was your what was your light at the, when at that time?
There were a lot of times when there wasn't a lot of light. The answer is a lot of the time it was fear that kept me going. You know,
fear of
being rejected, fear of being left out. You know, I think one of the things that made me work really, really hard in school when I was in my teens and frankly through college was the thought that as long as I performed well enough in school, I would at least have some basis to say to people, you should accept me for this because I'm performing well at the things you're telling me to perform well at. So, you know, I think for most people, you know, coming out stories are all different, but for most of us, there's an enormous amount of pain and difficulty that people carry with them for some period of their life. And the hope is that you can, when you do come out, and it is liberating and to be yourself and bring your whole self to work or to your family life, et cetera, that you can take the pain that you went through and turn it into a sense of empathy for others who are left out and left behind.
So what did, give us your coming out story. What is your coming out story?
I'm an unusual coming out story because I actually told my parents that I was not sure about my sexuality before I told friends, which most of my friends, yeah. It's the other way around. My coming out was also affected by the fact that when I was in my early 20s, my father got cancer and passed away at age 54. And I was the oldest of four kids, still am the oldest of four kids. And
you were how old at that time?
I was 24 when he was diagnosed, and he passed away a year later, 24 and a half, 25, around my mid-20s. But my youngest sibling was 7 when my father died.
Wow.
And so I kind of checked out of living my own life for a while at that point. And then when I moved back to the U.S., I was in graduate school in the U.K., and when I moved back to the U.S., I kind of made a purposeful decision that I was going to start my life back at home as myself, and I'm grateful that I...
So it's a couple of years later when you came back. So
yeah.
You went to Harvard, Rhodes Scholar, when you say study overseas.
I was a Marshall Scholar, yeah.
Yes. Marshall Scholar overseas. Yeah. And so then you went on to, you taught at Georgetown, you were in think tanks, and then worked for the Obama campaign. And then he went into the State Department. And then you were appointed the ambassador to the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, the OSCE. Tell us a little bit what that's all about.
Sure. So I had worked for Secretary Clinton for the first 4 years of the Obama administration in the Human Rights Bureau in Washington, D.C., and covering Africa, Asia, as well as multilateral institutions. So the UN Human Rights Council, the UN, OSCE is also a multilateral institution. So the OSCE grew out of the Cold War, and it was originally a kind of meeting place for East and West, where the Soviets and the Americans and their respective allies and partners could come together. And the idea was to prevent, I mean, it was one of the diplomatic efforts to prevent conflict between two nuclear-armed powers and conflict in Europe. Once the Berlin Wall fell and Eastern Europe was liberated from communism, and there was a big effort to integrate Eastern Europe, the Eastern European countries, into the international system. And the OSCE ended up playing an important role in training judges and helping build ministries of democratic states and helping those countries become part of the whole. Mm-hmm. And it remains very active today. So when I went to post in 2013, September of 2013, I had no idea what was awaiting me. But 3 months later, people in Ukraine started protesting against their then president's kowtowing to Putin and turning away from Europe. And a revolution followed. And there was a new government in Ukraine. And the Russians invaded and seized Crimea, which they continue to illegally occupy today, mm-hmm. and invaded in eastern Ukraine. And so all of a sudden, I was negotiating agreements to send international monitors in to report on the conflict. We were every week having often multiple sessions of what's called the Permanent Council, where all 57 ambassadors sit around a formal room and debate the issues of the day. And we were really in the thick of things. And I think I was the only U.S. official during that time when we were really challenged by Putin's aggression in Ukraine, I was the only U.S. official who had a weekly meeting, standing meeting with my Russian counterpart. So oftentimes I was, you know, having that meeting and rushing back to my mission to send back classified cables on what I was hearing from him, not because I trusted that he was giving me the whole truth and nothing but the truth, but what he was telling me could indicate something about what they were interested in. And so I was actively reporting back to Washington. So it was an interesting time.
And you did not, Putin wanted you eventually expelled from the country, correct?
Or yes, there was one incident where after we had these debates every week, and the Russians would say more and more outrageous and false things, denying that they were in Ukraine, you know, denying everything that they were doing. And the Russians didn't like me because I was always tough coming back on them and pointing out where they're exposing their lies. And at one point I said that the Russians were playing a gangster's game of, you know, watch the red, not the black, trying to distract people from what was going on the ground. And the next week, Putin's foreign ministry put out a statement saying that they had nothing more to say to me and that I was rude and shouldn't be a diplomat. The Russian diplomats that I interacted with, some of them were also deeply homophobic, which I could use to my advantage, because to the extent that it made, I wasn't uncomfortable by their homophobia, but they were uncomfortable with my being gay. And so I could use that to my advantage when I was jousting with them. And they accused me of non-traditional diplomatic intercourse, which was a play on words, because they had just passed an anti-gay law that used a different version of that, and so I managed to use that to my advantage. And
how do you use that to your advantage diplomatically?
Because you throw it back at them, and you say, yeah, you know, I mean, I am not a traditional diplomat, and by the way, any traditional diplomat would tell you that lying every day when you come into this room to your colleagues is the most disrespectful thing you could possibly do. And part of what you're doing is not just speaking to them, you're speaking to the room and reminding people that when the Russian ambassador comes in every day and tells us bald-faced lies, he is not actually doing anything that deserves our respect, and in fact showing disrespect to all of us. And I think part of what was important was being a strong American voice to help lead the group of other ambassadors and help us put pressure on the Russians to stop their violations of international law and stand up for international rules.
If you were to go to Washington, what insights from your time there could you give us about the Russians' continued efforts to screw with our democracy? I'm sure you, I don't know if you got any hints of that then, but I'm guessing not surprising to you based on what you saw.
No, it wasn't surprising. I mean, I was calling out Russia's efforts to undermine democracy and the international system before it was cool to do so, I think.
If only we had listened.
Well, no, that's not what I mean, but I had an upfront seat to what they were trying to do in their neighbor, and it was not surprising. You know, Putin has an objective of undermining the rule of law, democratic systems, not because he has some kind of peculiar, you know, religious commitment to undermining democracy, but because it's a direct challenge to his stranglehold on what is a gangster state where he has extracted billions upon billions of dollars over recent decades from the Russian people. And any international progress on democracy and human rights is a direct threat to him, because if the Russian people were to live in a state that had accountability, that had rule of law, that had justice, Vladimir Putin couldn't be the leader of that state. And so that is why he was threatened by a democratic revolution in Ukraine. It wasn't because he was trying to help an old friend. It was because that's a direct challenge to him. And I think, you know, certainly Putin saw the opportunity to undermine our 2016 election as an opportunity to reduce the pressure that would be on him from an America that was strong and leading in the world. And I think one of the things that President Trump and the administration have failed to do is to deliver serious consequences for the growing list of ways in which we now know that the Russians interfered in our elections. And while I think the investigations of the president that are proceeding in Congress based on the findings of the Mueller report need to proceed, I think we also shouldn't take our eye off the ball that we have another election coming up in 18 months, and we have not taken enough steps to defend our democratic process and to mete out consequences to those who have tampered with
it. What should we have done, or should we do in terms of consequences to the Russians?
In terms of consequences of the Russians, there's room to ramp up sanctions on individuals and entities that were involved. Obviously, Congress has had to intercede several times because the Trump administration has been unwilling to implement the sanctions that even Congress has called for. There should be a strategy. And one of the challenges that we have right now is that President Trump's foreign policy seems to be all reflex and no brain. There's a bunch of knee-jerk reactions around the world without coherent strategies that would actually accomplish diplomatic objectives. And when I talk to voters in Colorado, obviously most voters, as you know, don't spend, you know, their mental space is occupied with their lives and right. making their lives better. So they don't spend a lot of time thinking about what the diplomatic strategy should be vis-a-vis yeah. North Korea.
Nobody cares.
Iran.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But they do understand that the world being unsafe and chaotic out there is something that makes them less comfortable at home. And they want to see a restoration of the kind of coherent, solid, strategic engagement with the world. And one of the things I'm surprised by, frankly, that I hear is people will come up to me after an event. They'll say, the thing that I like most about you is that you're a diplomat, both because I think we need more diplomats in Congress, but also because I think we need people who have a sense of what America's role could be and should be in the world and how to work with other countries to solve the international challenges we face.
I want to get to some of your stance on the issues, but there's a couple of things I want to just touch base with you on about your experiences overseas and being a gay man. You said, remember, the Russian ambassador had been, the British ambassador told you that the Russians were going around for weeks. There's this new American ambassador. He's a homosexual and he's 36. They were freaked out by your, not only that you're gay, but that you're a young gay man. And then when you met with the representatives of the Holy See, the Vatican, they read Bible verses to you. So what's that all about?
Yeah, you know,
trying to help you out, or
it was. I will give him the Monsignor the benefit of the doubt and assume that he was only being loving. but look, you know, I mean,
I laugh as a Catholic. Go ahead.
The point people used to say, "What's it like to be a gay ambassador?" And I would say, the fact that I'm gay is neither here nor there in terms of my being an ambassador. What matters is that I'm the American ambassador, and yes. and that is a role that I take very seriously, and that I think comes with a special responsibility because of the role the United States can play in the world. Which is not to say that I don't recognize the significance of the fact that when I graduated from high school in 1995, I couldn't have gotten a top secret security clearance, and
right.
that you know.
Explain why.
Because you could still be fired in the 90s for being gay from the federal government, and security clearances were certainly not available to people who were closeted because of concerns around blackmail. But even if you were openly gay, which should remove the blackmail opportunity, you were not allowed to have a security clearance. And so, you know, there was enormous progress made. I didn't. When I found out that the Russian ambassador had been going around saying, oh, the new American is a homosexual and he's 36, you know.
By the way, it's a terrible Russian accent.
It was pretty close to Andre.
Okay.
The muttering was more than the accent.
Okay.
He would, you know, that didn't faze me because I knew that I was the American ambassador. And frankly, whether he wanted to or not, I was the person that he was going to deal with. And I think, you know, for every kind of story of somebody feeling awkward about that, there were a lot of beautiful stories. I mean, the day after the shooting at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando, which was a really moving and difficult thing as an American representing our country overseas, you feel both the tragedy of the loss of your fellow Americans, but also you have to explain this to people, and people want to know, you know, how are you feeling and how does this happen and that kind of thing. And we had a formal meeting of the permanent council that week, and the Canadian ambassador spoke up and she said, you know, when I first heard the news, my first thoughts were of my brother who lives in New York and of Dan and Brian, my American colleague and his husband. And I think that it's good that other ambassadors around the table, that was what they heard Isabel say was her first reaction upon hearing that news. And I think when I spoke about how it made me feel as a gay man to know that a place that was, you know, gay clubs are a place of safety, are supposed to be a place of safety for a population that has faced enormous physical violence and continues to face enormous physical violence. And those were largely LGBTQ people of color who were killed there. And talking about, when we put human rights in an international context, talking about what it feels like to feel safe enough to be who you are, it had special weight. And so I think there were times where it was actually really important that I was.
And again, it's humanizing. It goes back to the Colorado stat about 2/3 of people don't know someone or that they know is gay. And you got married overseas in Austria when it wasn't legal to be married there. How do you pull that off?
So we pulled it off by actually doing the documentation in Washington, D.C. Okay. And then we actually didn't even tell our mothers.
so it's kind of an elopement.
And so we did the marriage ceremony in Vienna in our backyard. And we were married by a friend who had been the special representative for special envoy for monitoring and combating anti-Semitism, who is herself, she is a rabbi. And when I saw Tim Snyder, who's a Ukraine expert and an academic at Yale, when I saw him in Ukraine a few months later, he asked me about my wedding, and I told him, and he said, you know, two men getting married by a female rabbi in Vienna. That is tactful yet unambiguous in the message it sends. And I decided right then and there that, like, being tactful and unambiguous is a good way to go through life.
Oh, absolutely. That's a great motto. So let's talk about, and after you left the State Department, did you leave, did you quit or were you fired?
The Trump transition team first sent a message asking for a resignation about, I think, 9 a.m. on November 9th. So we had less than 12 hours of to let what had happened sink in. And it was a crazy time. Actually, on November 8th, or in the middle of the night on November 8th, my husband turned to me and said, look, the values that we care most about are most under threat. In terms of the future of the world, they're most seriously under threat at home, and we need to be home and be part of our community and figure out how to be on the fight for making good things happen.
So let's talk about how your plan is to make some of those good things happen. And we're going to speak broadly in terms of some of the issues that resonate across the country. On healthcare, you are, many folks, certainly in the progressive end of the spectrum for Medicare for All, you're not quite there. Tell us about where you're at on Medicare for All.
Well, I have said, and I know that when this plays, people are going to write to you and say, oh, that's not his idea. But I will note that it's in a interview from before last week. I've said that I'm for Medicare for all who need it, or Medicare for all who want it, which is a way of saying that,
is it like a public option?
When we have a system where there are people who don't have coverage or don't have access to affordable coverage, and we have a huge portion of Americans who either through their union or through their employers do have coverage. And I'm not saying that the system that we have is the system we ought to have. But if you're trying to take a medical term, if you're going to triage and focus your attention on the places where the need is greatest, you should focus your attention on the places where people don't have it or don't have affordable coverage. And, you know, there are two progressive women in Congress who have put forward a plan called Medicare for America, a piece of legislation called Medicare for America, that could be seen as a starting point. Obviously, nothing gets through Congress without negotiation, but it could be seen as a starting point for the kind of negotiation over a plan that would give Medicare, expand Medicare first to all who need it, to all who need it now. And then I would imagine that would be the first step in addressing.
But you don't want to disrupt everyone's healthcare. As you, I think you said in the past, many union folks have great plans themselves. Many of them have Cadillac plans, as they were called back in the day. And you don't want to disrupt the system. Why take away healthcare from plans from people who like them and they're very good.
When I talk to people, what I hear from folks is that they would like, including those who have coverage through their union or employer, they understand that nobody in America, we are a rich enough country that nobody in America should be bankrupted or not be able to get the care that they need. But they think it makes sense to start with those who don't have it, who don't have affordable care. And that makes sense to me. And I think as you look at what has happened in the politics of healthcare in the last decade, we made enormous progress with the ACA. Obviously, we made progress in terms of the number of people covered and expansion of coverage, but we also made progress in the American people's minds. People now recognize that the U.S. government has a role to play in ensuring that everybody be covered. And I think we should take that progress that we've made and build on it and fulfill the promise of having everybody be covered with affordable care. And we should work on driving down the costs, which I think if we start this way with Medicare for all who need it, we will also, in doing so, help drive down the cost of coverage, because that's another real issue for a lot of people.
And you live in one of the most beautiful states in the union, one of my favorite states, and the environment's very important. But you are not for the Green New Deal. Again, that's sort of an aspirational thing. But what are the challenges you have with that?
Oh, I the only challenge I would say that I have is that it is an umbrella term, the policies under which have not been fully laid out yet. And so I absolutely recognize that we need to see a dramatic transformation in our economy. And I think in order to make it sustainable and in order to avoid leaving our children a dying planet. My husband is a climate economist for the World Bank. He works every day on how to protect poor people from the effects of climate change. This is something that we talk about at the dinner table. It is certainly very, and obviously in Colorado, you know, the ski industry as well as our tourism industry, yes, more broadly, is a huge chunk of our economy, mm-hmm, and is very susceptible to the changes of climate change. So this is an important economic issue for us. I think there's no question that what we need is going to be a set of solutions. It's not going to be one piece of legislation. It's going to be a set of legislation in the same way that the original New Deal was not just one piece of legislation, but referred to a package of legislation. And the ideas should be both as ambitious as the original New Deal, as well as focused not just on traditional environmental issues, but also on the question of how we're going to make this an economic opportunity for America. America at our best deals with huge challenges by finding in them opportunities to score economic victories. And I think that the challenge of climate change is one where we can do that too.
All right. Ambassador Dan Baer, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
I'd like to thank you all for listening today. I'd like to thank Ambassador Baer for coming to visit us here in San Francisco. I'd like to thank the King, King Kaufman, for producing today's podcast. And remember, whether you're a gay ambassador or a Russian dictator, it's all political. It's All Political is part of the San Francisco Chronicle podcast network. Audrey Cooper is our editor-in-chief. Our music, our theme music that we have, is Cattle Call. That's written by Randy Clark. If you like this show, subscribe, rate, and review it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. For more great journalism like this, subscribe to the San Francisco Chronicle at sanfranciscochronicle.com/subscribe. You can find me on Twitter at Joe Garofoli. Thanks.